we're surrounded by stories that just don't add up. Choices that appear to be baffling, actions that defy logic. But what if there's more to the story? On How Did It Make Sense, we explore the power of learning from experience and digging into the second stories that are always present. We talk to experts from diverse fields who are challenging the way we think about safety, risk, and decision making. Join us as we unlock the lessons hidden within everyday events. Some of these are high risk and some appear to be mundane, but all of them show how we can create a fairer, safer, and more resilient world. Welcome to another edition of How Did It Make Sense? Haven't had one for a while, been really busy, lots of other stuff going on, but are really pleased to have, what I say is a friend now, Sabine, who's a fellow graduate from Lund, join me on this podcast. And it's available on the main channels, Spotify, Apple, and YouTube. And the goal is really to explore the deeper stories behind those simple linear first stories that we hear. So Sabine, introduce yourself. Who are you? What do you do? How did you get to where you are now? And where can people find you either in social media or in the real world?
Hi, Gareth. Thanks for having me. I'm Sabine. I used to be a flight attendant for 8 years. Then I switched to become a midwife in Austria. Did that for 8 years. And then I switched again because I always found it so interesting how those two systems were completely different for me as a frontliner. I really felt the difference in how they would approach things and the problems or human errors. And and so I got very invested in this topic, became quite invested in simulation training. And now I'm working as a consultant in a consultancy company that is very busy in helping companies, but also the medical field to improve non-technical skills and to just also bring this sociological view into organizations. So, and this is totally. Where I went to Lund, and this is where we met.
indeed. And it's really interesting. So the small world, I would, you know, before we started, we were talking about the last week I was in Chepstow at the HEC Global Series conference, and Drew Ray from Griffiths University was there presenting, and he gave a very good presentation. We were talking about non-technical skills and crew resource management in the non-aviation space. And one of the things I'm going to do is upload it after this, that it is part of this podcast, is a paper that just talks about the different views of what non-technical skills and crew resource management mean across those different domains, because there's not consensus. And that in itself causes a challenge. And what are we trying to achieve? So, you know, both you and I are working in that sort of high-performance team development, error reduction, creating a shared mental model within the teams. And it's not easy. It's not easy to try and get that message across to people. And it does require a bit of an enlightenment on behalf of the people who want to improve in their teams. They recognize that it's not a 5-minute job. It's not pitching or presenting to 50 people in a theater and say, right, can you teach us teamwork in half an hour or half a day to 50 people in one go? It's like, not really, no.
It's climbing mountains.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it's about that connection and understanding the rationale behind how and why people do what they do. And that really is the core of this podcast, is how did it make sense? So we start with a first story. So tell us, Sabine, what is the first story of this, well, I suppose, learning journey, I suppose, is for you and for our audience here.
So, as I said, I worked as a midwife. And as a midwife in Austria, you're very often confronted with the feeling that you're only a midwife. So it's not so much what the public thinks about you, because they really appreciate midwifery work. So this is clear. But in the intramural setting, so working in hospitals, it is not so clear who is like really in charge, who is leading groups in the intramural setting. And I found it so funny because you wrote in your LinkedIn comment on my thesis, you wrote what everybody thinks, something like that, what everybody thinks is straightforward is not so straightforward. So this is the first story. What is straightforward? Like, what is the first story? And for midwives, the first story would be whenever there is a normal birth, it's just very clear and unambiguous. It's just very clear, sorry, it's just very clear that we are in charge of normal births, we, the midwives. And for obstetricians, for physicians, it would be every birth that lands in a hospital, that takes place in a hospital, is per definition physician led. So we have two worlds colliding here, and the result is just whatever happens in this negotiation of power. So the one professional group being more, showing more assertiveness, showing more powerful traits, they will win, so to speak.
And it's really interesting that, as you know, Joe Public, me as a, as you know, as a layperson, you don't know much about this stuff. You don't understand those dynamics. And just as you're discussing there, and I'm thinking, well, surely I have midwives in the hospital as well. So that must make things even more dynamic, where at least if you are, I'm going to say, geographically spaced, or, you know, you've got dislocation, then it might be a little bit clearer as to where that clarity, role clarity, responsibility, accountability, whatever the terms are. But then when you start to sort of bring them together, and you have these sort of the Venn diagram of the mother, the midwife, and the obstetrician as to where that relationship and that power dynamic exists. And one of the things that I loved when I read your thesis is, this is about healthcare, but it's just like another little microcosm of the world, of the corporate space, the safety space, whatever it is, where we've got this interplay between the relationships and the power dynamics that are there. And we sit there and go, okay, when everything goes well, we can each take our own little, that was our victory. That was, we created that success. But when things start to go downhill, then it's that bit of, I'm in charge. Now I'm in charge. And then it goes wrong. It's like, well, you were in charge. Yeah.
My first story would be like, I have thousands of first stories where I would just be in my labor room, being with the mother. Midwives would typically say with my woman. So there is this ownership with my birth, with my woman, which is very interesting from a critical discourse and analytical point of view. If you claim this ownership. And so I would be with my woman and with my birth. And then somebody meaning a physician, an obstetrician, would interfere and would do something that I would not appreciate. And I would feel that they did not have any right to do so. But at the same time, I would lack mechanisms to keep them away from my labor room. I would feel powerless from time to time, depending on who the person was. So if trust played a huge role, if I trusted the person, then it would not be a problem, because then I could just say, please, I have everything under control. Or I would even like this person to be in the room, and it would not bother me at all. But of course, it would always bother me with people I did not like, or that I, from a professional point of view, did not value that much. I thought that they were not making good decisions, or that they would pathologize my birth. And now again, my birth.
The ownership of that's really interesting.
Absolutely. It's a huge identification with what you're doing as a midwife. So midwives are also in the public world, from the WHO and everywhere, they are positioned as the guardians of normality, whatever normality is. So same thing with normality as with non-technical skills. So we do not have a definition. Yeah. And then again, the medical professions, they would be positioned as the guardians of safety. So this is really interesting when those two views are suddenly like separated. Safety is not the same as normality, or is normality not the same as safety? And how do we view safety at all, individually and as professional groups? So the first story would be, don't come and bother me in my labor ward. This is my room, this is my woman, and this is my birth. Go!
And what's really interesting is this is your first story as the midwife. And one of the things you sort of really learn about this stuff is exploring what other people's first stories and their second stories are, which I think was, you know, is the key bit from your research, was what are the different paradigms that were there? And how did people, you know, those stakeholders, the mother, the obstetrician and the midwife, how was that interplay? And it was interesting, you know, when you talk about my as an identity, is whether or not that the medical professionals also had an I, or ownership, that, or my rather than I, the my that went with that. So what was the, you know, basically the research that you did, And what was the research question? I think you got the prize for the longest title at Lund for a paper or for the thesis. But what was the general thing that you were trying to explore to unwrap and untangle that second story around the relationships that were going on?
I have to say that I went into this whole process like really emotionally loaded. I was really raged. I was in a very bad mood.
Sorry.
And you played some kind of role in that.
I know, yeah. Okay.
As you know. So just to clear the air, Gareth was nothing but like really nice and open to me. But he nailed it when he said to me, or when you said to me, that somebody told you behind my back, I was not included in this conversation. So you don't need to listen to Sabine. She's only a midwife. And when I started this journey in Lund, I was really self-conscious. I got to know all those very smart people who had already 5 master degrees and 17 PhDs and wrote books and I don't know what. And I came there and I really felt myself, what am I doing here? I'm only a midwife. Yeah, I used to be a flight attendant and now I'm only a midwife. And what am I doing here? And where did I get myself into? I'm not so smart. I can't do that. And
you proved them wrong.
I did. So this was actually the feeling I took home with me from Learning Lab 1 and in January. And then we wrote the first few assignments and I thought, oh, okay, like they are not that smart. Like we are all just learning.
yeah, exactly.
Just learning. Like we all get to know this new domain and this new language and we have to play with that and coming from our distinct perspectives. And I started to feel safe where we are all just people going somewhere together.
Yeah.
And so it really hit me hard when you confronted me with this sentence in Learning Lab 2 when I actually felt safe and then bam.
The irony being around just culture and safety as a cultural setting.
Yes. And I really was like, okay, damn it. Now they know. They know that I don't fit in here. Somebody knows that I'm a fraud. I really felt that way. And it was so painful. And I did not want to write about it at first. But then at Learning Lab 3 in November, I still had your voice in my head. And this is the learning lab where you, as you know, discuss what your thesis will be about. And I talked to Anthony Smoker, and I told him the story, like tearing up again. Like I'm really proud of myself that I'm not tearing up right now, because I'm always tearing up when I talk about it. And then he said, Sabina, you have to write about that. So going back to the title, I was really emotional in the beginning, because for me, this thesis was an act of resistance, or it is an act of resistance. And this is why I chose Foucault, and this is why I chose a critical discourse analysis inspired by Fairclough, because I really wanted to show the discourses behind a sentence like that. What do we really say when we say things? And in Austria, there is this saying that behind every joke, there is truth.
Mm.
And I'm sure there is something similar.
And sometimes that can be a little bit sort of protective. There's dissonance involved there. It's just like you sit there going, oh, okay, is that how I behave? Oh, but you've got to have a level of sort of self-awareness for that to sink
Absolutely. So for me, I was, because everybody's talking about culture all the time. And they would also talk in Austria about culture in the labor ward.
Mm-hmm.
But culture is only a product of colliding discourses. And the culture is the result of what is negotiated between those discourses. So we have the obstetrics discourse, which I now, and this is the second story, I completely understand. I understand their point of view. I understand they are just doing what their subject positioning asks them to do. And then we have midwives, and they are also positioned, and they also act the way that the system wants them to act, except of me, because I have my act of resistance now.
but it's an interesting piece. There was something that Drew Ray had said was, you know, one of the reasons we have all of these structures and processes in place around safety is to reduce anxiety, be that individual anxiety, organizational anxiety, or anxiety from the regulators and things like this. And I'm just thinking of this, and he said the antidote to anxiety is knowledge. And I think that piece here is, once you start to understand the different perspectives, it's no longer a threat or an upsetting or an uncertainty, because now we've got a better idea of how and why people behave the way they do. And I'm just thinking of, you know, why I love this bit is the ability to abstract into other spaces. So your bit about the discourse of the midwives and the obstetricians, it's the discourse of the accountancy team in an organization, of the operations team, of the safety team, of the executive team who face the shareholders. They've all got their own discourse as to how and why an organization or a company behaves the way it does. And you sort of so eloquently described, it's that collision and that manipulation and the friction and the discussions that have to happen to understand where people are coming from.
Absolutely.
So I think it's a really, and I think there's this bit, if you look at something going, well, that's just obstetrics and midwifery, but actually it's just a microcosm of life.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got to have the curiosity and the ability to abstract up and out and go, actually, it's not just about the healthcare space.
Yeah. And this is also what I share now with my colleagues from both professional groups. I share it with my midwifery colleagues to like, as you said, it's knowledge, but who's on the table when knowledge is created? Mm. And whose knowledge is recognized and acknowledged, and whose knowledge is not? And then we dive into this accountability topic.
Mm.
And what I found...
Go on, dig into it. Go
yeah,
on, because
exactly.
It was a really interesting piece. Who is accountable?
Who is accountable? And who is accountable in which sense? Because we have the legal accountability, and clearly both professional groups have legal accountability. But because legal accountability is executed so seldom in or rarely in Austria.
Yeah.
Gott sei Dank. I'm happy about that. I don't want to change that ever. But the problem is that there are a lot of myths around that. So there was one obstetrician who said, we have this Glaubenssatz, this inner knowledge or inner belief. She said this inner belief that that only we are accountable. And this leads to this interference that they always want to be included in births. They always want to know everything, and they would not, for their feeling, births are pathological in a certain way. No birth is normal because everything can happen all the time.
Okay.
And to keep it safe, they have to be very proactive. Management. They have to do things to keep it normal. Whereas a midwife would say, I don't want to do anything to keep it normal.
Yeah, yeah.
And only
whatever normal means. Exactly. You mean naturally normal or medically normal. Yeah.
Exactly. In the respective discourse, normal. And absolutely. So what happens instead of legal accountability is hierarchical accountability. So midwives do very rarely, almost never, at least in Austria, are never taken into account in the organization itself. Whereas obstetricians, at every end of their shift, they will have a meeting with the other obstetricians, and then they will have to explain why they, and now I'm referring to, to one obstetrician who said, why I yanked out such a poorly conditioned baby.
Okay.
Even though he or she did not even yank it out, because the midwife yanked it out, if you want to use
I was going to say, the words make worlds, you know, the power of, and I think that was another piece that came out of yours was the sorts of language that was used to describe interactions and behaviors, which is certainly not the sort of thing you get in what you would expect to hear in a healthcare setting.
Yes. So terms like the labor ward is a battlefield, and you have to choose your battles, and you have to choose your ammunition, and you have to be careful that you have ammunition whenever you need it in their interaction with obstetricians. This also was very surprising to me, because I'm a midwife myself, and I never was aware how that this sort of
language was used
when I was actively working as a midwife. So, but in every interview, you would find those militaristic language styles, and I even found a picture. I found a picture where there would be a soldat, how is it called in the war? A soldier on his knees, protecting a person lying in the bed, sleeping. And behind there would be the letters sectio, also C-section, sectio.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
The midwife would be the soldier who is protecting the woman. So it's very powerful pictures. And all those symbols and all this language showing that there is like a historically grown divide of two professional groups. So, and my wish was to check if there is a shared discourse as well. And I didn't find
it. Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, again, that might be my sort of views. Surely the preservation of life is that highest level of discourse that's there, but it's how you achieve that. So the destination is probably common, but the journey to get to the destination might not be. You don't agree?
I think maybe it's simplifying a bit, because...
Oh, absolutely.
Always, like we always try to do that. And I wished I could like just simply say yes, absolutely. But to be fair, I feel that both professional groups do not really think about those things. Like I as you talked about knowledge, and I really, my research really showed that there are a lot of knowledge deficits in both professional groups concerning the other professional groups, their roles, their obligations, their rights, but also of one's own professional group, which is like, which really stunned me. I it shook me. And it's so often in healthcare, and I bet also in other professional fields, that professional groups who should work together in a team are trained separately.
Yes.
So in their own silos, busy developing their own paradigms, their own professional identities, not looking left or right, getting to know like the interfaces.
Yeah.
The
connections, the collaborating.
We want collaboration, but we introduce them in, and the midwife would say, on the battlefield.
Yes. No.
Late.
Totally. And it's something that I've picked up in healthcare outside is this disparity between sort of physicians and nurses. And this bit that there is a level of educational support and development that exists in the medical professional side where they get, you know, funding and they can do these trainings, and the nurses don't have that same opportunity. And the lack of team training. So they'll talk about multidisciplinary team discussions where they talk about a patient or have the rounds where we talk about that. But there doesn't appear to be or limited opportunities to go and do multidisciplinary team training. So you understand those perspectives and trying to do it in a manner where there isn't professional jeopardy. And it's certainly something I've managed in the past using the computer-based simulation, which is, you know, is nobody can bring any prior knowledge to. You can mess around with team dynamics, so you can put a nurse leading a surgeon, anesthetist, another nurse, and they feel very uncomfortable. And then you can take the voice away from the surgeon because they've had a stroke or their intercom's failed, and they've just got to sit there quietly, not allowed to say anything or do anything, and they feel really uncomfortable because they can see stuff but they can't say anything about it. And you say to them in the debrief, what's it like not to have a voice? I'm like, I hated it. I could see there's a train wreck arriving, but I can't see anything. I can't say anything there and then. I said, so what do you think it's like on the ward or the operating theatre when you've got a nurse who's in that same position? Oh, so that's what it's like not to have a voice. I mean, that's exactly what it's like. But the thing is, in a medical simulation setting, you can't do that because people have got professional roles that they've got to do to execute the technical task that's there. Whereas actually taking those sorts of discussions and dimensions outside of the professional space allows you to explore some of those. And the light bulb moments are brilliant. It's why we both love our job in that sense, is people go, oh, right. Absolutely. So what was the biggest surprise in your research then?
I think the biggest surprise was that my reaction, that I suddenly did not think, oh, they are assholes anymore. But like, of course, this is now very bluntly spoken. But you know what I mean? Like I really understood where they were coming from, their mindset and their reasoning. I just understand. And it even makes me feel sorry for them. Because the system asks things of them that they cannot provide. They cannot be accountable for something they are not a part of the most of the time because they have other things to do. And the midwife is there all of the time, and she is neglected that accountability. So this does not make sense. So I really understand them, and this was came as a shock to me. The other really... a surprising thing was how creative both professional groups are in managing this dependence on one another.
Okay.
It's like a dance around the fire. Yes.
Yeah.
And And because we do not have the room or the floor to just
space,
talk
yeah.
about it,
yeah.
They really find, and I did it myself. We really have very creative measures to work with the other professional group to keep them away as a midwife or to get included as an obstetrician. And I found that very interesting. And
the dance, yeah.
Exactly. And that both people, both professional groups do it because, of course, they want to sustain their discourse, but also because they feel that they do the best for the women, but the women are actually not in the picture. And this
the
is
irony.
Really hurtful. It's really hurtful. Yeah. And I have to say, and it's hurtful to say it, but this this is for both professional groups, for midwives and for obstetricians, that that what they are doing is quite disempowering at times to women, because midwives do everything they can to keep it normal, and they would try to influence the women to keep it normal, and they would say things like, "You have a very normal. We will now make a. Is it okay for you now if we make a midwife-led birth, because everything is normal, and we just get the doctor if we needed him or her," and of course this no woman could say no. Like, how could
exactly.
she? There is so much pressure.
So when
on
you
her,
frame she... that, wow, yeah.
Yes, exactly, and they would feel I'm empowering the woman because she needs to have a normal birth, and but actually it's not that. And for obstetricians, it would be more into the direction of keeping it safe through a lot of measures.
It looks a little bit. Are you sure you want to go? We can bring you on the ward. And then things will be under a little bit more control. And if things do go wrong, then we can respond more quickly. And who's going to say no to that?
Exactly. So I the creativeness of that was really surprising and also funny at times. Like what I really liked interviewing my peers from both professional groups. And I really loved how open they were. And but I also provided the space for a focus group, and you could see four people, two midwives and two obstetricians, sitting on one table talking about things like that. This was new to them, and so many aha moments, like, oh wow,
awesome.
Really, this is how you experienced that. I wasn't aware of that. And from both directions. And I felt, okay, we have to open up those spaces. We have to just, knowledge is created here. And
awesome.
We have to invite the people who are in the front line to create this knowledge and not just one group.
Yeah. So when you create a focus group like that and you've created the trust, then you don't need to run away from the conversation or the discourse that's there, because it's right in front of you, and you're going to learn. What's your response been when the paper, your thesis, has been shared to both communities? Have you had any feedback as to where they've read it without your direction and guidance? What's your response been?
The response was very positive from both professional groups.
Okay, cool.
And I think the reason for that was that I really took measures because of course it's constructed. This piece is also socially constructed.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm co-constructing. So I really tried to reduce biases and invited, for example, one colleague of mine who is both a midwife and an obstetrician, because she has just one soul in her breast and she knows both perspectives. And I said, please help me to, like, I don't want to midwife around here. I want to be a researcher. And and she really helped me. And so... I think I managed doing that, and So the feedback was good. And but of course, with the midwives, it was, even though I'm critical about the midwifery parts, as said, militaristic language and a lot of other things that they don't know their law, that like there are a lot of things that I'm very critical about, but they say we want more of that. We need to, in times like these, where midwives are leaving their profession, field of work, they are leaving hospitals because they feel that they cannot work autonomously anymore. We have to change something. And I feel that also conditions of possibilities.
Yes.
I feel that also obstetricians, they experience it the same way.
Has there been any, in the UK, we've got the Royal Colleges where we've got surgeons, anaesthetists, obstetricians, nurses and things. Do you have a similar system in Austria, and have you taken it to them to get their sort of perspective, i.e. the education space start at that level? Or is that too big a step?
I wrote an article for our midwifery journal.
Okay.
About my research. Like you might be familiar with that.
Yay,
one.
Cool.
So it's printed already. The title is a bit shorter here, as you can see. And no offense taken. And yes, absolutely. I'm a lecturer in one university of applied sciences. This is how we do that in Austria for midwifery. And I'm a lecturer there. I used to be a lecturer already, and now I of course invite discourses into. Mm-hmm. Into my my lectures, because I just want to provide them with another perspective, and I want to give them. I don't want to say ammunition now, because.
No, but I was actually thinking from the other side, from the obstetrics. Have you able to got into that side of things? So the midwifery, that bit of you can help provide some level of defense engagement from the midwifery side, but there's also somebody needs to act as the guide, the sort of, I don't know what the term, the sort of say, look, here's the story from the other side.
Of course you cannot make a research like I did and then do nothing with it, at least not if you're Sabine Fürst. And so what I am trying to do now, together with some colleagues from several professional groups working in a labor ward, like anesthesiologists, nurses, obstetricians, to kick off a conference, like the first truly interprofessional conference on labor care.
Awesome.
And yes, and we will have a kickoff on that in September. There are coming a lot of people.
Well done.
There are 12 or 13 people, and we will talk about how we can transfer this knowledge, and not only this knowledge, but how we truly engage those groups and break up some silos. And for me, the most important thing is still education. If we are starting to bring them together after education, for me, that's too late, but at least it's better than nothing. So when I say, what is my purpose in life? I would like to get some little holes in the walls that got built
Brilliant.
Up. And this is what I want to do. And this is what I'm doing.
Awesome. And that final piece there about windows or holes in the walls reminds me of something that came back from Ben Goodhart at the Community of Human and Organizational Learning. And talking about, instead of knocking the walls down, is putting windows in the silos, putting windows in the walls.
Exactly.
And that's what we do as, I'm going to say, the sort of human factor system safety people, is the connectors that work across different domains, because people are people. It's just the stories that change. And it's that ability to abstract and just say, you know what, we're not all different. We are all broadly the same. So what can we do that reinforces the good stuff, and we knock down the bad stuff? So
exactly.
So helping with So with helping more knowledge transfer, we sort of wrap up with a recommendation of one or more of a book or a paper or a video to help people grow and learn. And I'm going to put something in about the non-technical skills from YOP in Griffiths. But what would you suggest people go and consume and reflect on? And I will put that in the links as best I can.
There is a brand new on July 5th, an article or an editorial in The Lancet, a very important journal in my field. And it's about empowering women during childbirth. And I would recommend this one because there is one citation I would like to share with you. It's much harm comes from two competing ideologies about childbirth, neither based on best evidence, over-medicalization of birth, and excessive emphasis on so-called natural birth. So this is exactly what I dealt with in my research. And I love...
So is your paper in there then? Have you been
not
cited?
Not yet. But I really love that now the discourse, not because of me, but conditions of possibility.
You're magnifying it, you're collimating it. So it is. So it's about...
It's beautiful. It's beautiful that people out there are getting busy exploring how much damage we might do to ourselves, to our colleagues, and most importantly, to the women in care and their children in care. If we do not change and if we do not look at our relationships, we have to talk about our relationships.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think that piece of looking at our relationships is, as we had on the last learning lab we had, is the relationship we have with ourselves and the relationship we have with the different other stakeholders that are out there and understand ourselves too. So, Sabina, thank you very much for your time and your accounts. I'll link the thesis and those papers to the show notes. So thank you. And hopefully we'll catch up soon in person again.
I truly do hope so, yes.
Excellent. Brilliant. Thanks so much, Sabina. Take care. Bye.